This holiday season, give the gift that everyone actually wants, Omaha Steaks. Right now, save 50% site-wide, plus an extra $35 off with code HOLIDAYGIFT at checkout. From USDA-certified very tender filet mignons and perfectly aged ribeyes, to juicy burgers and gourmet sides and desserts that make every meal unforgettable, Omaha Steaks brings steakhouse quality flavor straight to your doorstep. Whether you're gifting family across the country or filling your own freezer, every box arrives perfectly packaged and guaranteed to impress. Because nothing says I love you most like a gift of Omaha Steaks. Skip the malls and the guessing. Go to omahasteaks.com right now. That's omahasteaks.com to save 50% site-wide, plus get an extra $35 off with code HOLIDAYGIFT at checkout. Hurry, this deal won't last. Omaha Steaks, delivering joy since 1917. Minimum purchase may apply. See site for details.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
Now, what if everything you needed to know to understand the entire universe, from the Big Bang to black holes, from atoms to AI, could be boiled down to just one simple idea? Well, Marcus Chown thinks it can. He's a science writer and former radio astronomer whose new book is called The One Thing You Need to Know, The Simple Way to Understand the Most Important Ideas in Science. He joins me now. Marcus, great to have you back on the programme. I'm very intrigued to hear now. What is this one simple idea?
Well, it's obviously more than that. But basically, I got asked to give a talk in Cheltenham, a law firm. And they were interested in quantum computers. What is the future of quantum computers? This is a kind of buzzword or whatever. And they said, by the way, no one here knows anything at all about science. So I thought, wow, what am I going to do? So I thought, what is the one thing that you need to tell people about quantum computers from which everything else follows? And then I thought, well, why don't I do that for other topics as well, like the Big Bang, black holes, quantum theory? You know, what is the one idea, if you get that, most of the rest of the topic follows logically from it?
Oh, I think that is a difficult thing that you've tried to do, and also a genius way of approaching it, because there are actually some things that once someone has explained them in a particular way or explained how things work, it's been made everything. It's been a way of unlocking a topic. So that's fantastic. So this book, as we said, goes through so many different approaches to lots of different things in science that you may have heard of but don't quite understand, like second law of thermodynamics and plate tectonics and all these sort of things. But we're going to focus on three, and they are gravity, electricity, and global warming. And regular listeners to this program will know that electricity is my kryptonite. I've been explained it 1,000 times, so you have a challenge on your hands, Marcus, because every time I've been explained it, I haven't been able to understand it. And then gravity is one of those things that people hear about all the time, but they don't really understand it, I don't think, in the way that that scientists do. And then, of course, global warming, the biggest question of our time. So let's start off with gravity then. What is the one big idea that everyone should understand about gravity?
Well, gravity is a universal force. So every chunk of matter falls on every other matter with a force of attraction. So that means there's a gravitational force between you and the person you pass on the street. There's a gravitational force between you and the coins in your pocket. But this force is unbelievably weak, incredibly weak. It's billions and billions of times weaker than the electric force, for instance, which holds together the atoms in your body. And so you hardly notice this force. You know, you're not pulled towards someone as you pass them on the street. You're not really pulled towards the coins in your pocket. But the thing about gravity is that there is only one form of it. It's only attractive. So the more matter you get, the more attraction you get. So if we contrast this with the electric force, for instance, matter comes in two forms, positively charged and negatively charged. That means it can be both repulsive and attractive. So it turns out that there's an equal amount of this attractive and repulsive stuff in your body and in all the things around you. So it completely cancels out. But the gravity doesn't. So as you get more and more of this stuff, it becomes more and more powerful. And that's, of course, why it's dominant when we're talking about things the size of the Earth, the size of the Sun, the size of the galaxy, the size of the universe. But it's actually pretty minuscule in the everyday world.
It's not the size of something that makes it have a more powerful field of gravity. It's the amount of stuff in it. Isn't that right?
That's right, the amount of stuff. And it is a total mystery because we have this theory called the Standard Model. You may have heard of it, but it's actually the high point of 350 years of science. Basically, it's how the fundamental building blocks, which they turn out to be quarks, subatomic particles called quarks and leptons, things like the electron. And they're glued together by three forces. And this theory, the Standard Model, which has got to be the worst term for something so fantastic, describes how all these basic building blocks are glued together by these three particles, these three forces. And it predicts what we find in our experiments, what we see in the world, to an obscene number of decimal places. It's the most successful physical theory ever devised. But gravity is completely left out of the fold. So we have a completely separate theory for gravity. I mean, we obviously realize that Newton came up with the first theory of universal gravity, but that was actually extended or improved on by Einstein in 1915. But it sits completely out of this framework.
So I've heard that over and over again, and because we were talking about different things, I haven't sort of picked at that. But how can you have a theory of how our universe runs and talk about matter and energy and all of these things and not talk about gravity? How can you model a universe with gravity completely absent from it?
Well, gravity is used to model the universe because on those large scales, gravity basically beats everything else into submission. You know, when you get enough atoms together, if you look at the solar system, when you get enough atoms together, that's an object maybe about 300 kilometers across, then gravity dominates.
And that means, but you said in the Standard Model, and I've heard this before, gravity is not part of that.
That's right.
But that isn't Standard Model the model of the universe?
No. Here's the confusion. There is a Standard Model of cosmology, and there's a Standard Model of particle physics.
Could you not have come up with a different name? Oh, that's why I've been so confused for so many years. Why has no one ever pointed that out? So there's two Standard Models.
Well, yeah, absolutely. The Standard Model, which tends to be talked of just as the Standard Model, not even particle physics, the Standard Model. And then we have a Standard Model of the universe, absolutely.
Oh, right. Okay. I'm actually learning something.
Yeah. And that Standard Model, unfortunately, contains lots of things which are not in the Standard Model of particle physics. So, for instance, 95% of the universe is invisible. You know that. It's dark matter and dark matter. We have not the slightest clue what it is. So we have this incredible Standard Model of particle physics that predicts everything we see in around us in the everyday world. And it doesn't include these two incredible components, which we haven't got a clue what they are. So that's an incredible thing. That if you look around in the solar system, you'll see everything that's smaller than about 300 kilometers looks like a potato. Everything less than 300 kilometers across looks like a potato. And everything that's bigger than that looks like a sphere. And that's because gravity begins to dominate at that scale, and it can crush everything into the smallest volume, which is a sphere.
Very cool. I'm going to spare my poor listeners the constant diatribe I have against dark energy and dark matter, but I want to say to you very quickly, don't believe in them. I'm now going to move on to electricity.
Yeah.
So electricity, I have this brain blip. I just don't know how on earth electricity works. So what is the one thing that we need to know about electricity that will help us fully understand it?
Right. The one thing you need to know is the electric force is phenomenally powerful. Okay, so we just talked about gravity. The electric force is 10,000 billion, 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 billion times stronger than gravity. Okay, so that's unbelievably more powerful than gravity. So you may think to yourself, well, wait a minute, I'm glued together by the electric force. How is it when I walk past someone else who's glued together their atoms by an electric force? Why don't I feel this unbelievably powerful force? And again, as we were just saying, it's because there are two types of matter, positively charged, negatively charged. So there's repulsion and attraction, and they cancel out perfectly. But remember, if you can actually create a charge imbalance, you can unleash this unbelievably powerful force, right? So that's what we do in power stations, you know. So to give you some idea, I was thinking about this when I wrote the book, and I was thinking, how can I explain how powerful this force is? KK mosquito. I called him Terry. I don't know why, but I called him Terry. Terry, my pet mosquito. And he's made of atoms, like you and me. An atom is a little tiny positively charged nucleus around which, so like a sun, around which electrons orbit like planets. Okay, and the electrons are negatively charged and the nucleus is positively charged. And it's that attraction between the electrons and the nucleus that keeps it together. Now, so I could magically remove all the electrons from Terry, that would only leave the positively charged nuclei. Like charges repel, so Terry would explode. So I ask people when I give talks, would he explode? He's a mosquito, he's the size of a mosquito. Would he explode with the energy of a sparkler, the energy of a stick of dynamite, the energy of a nuclear explosion, or the energy of a global mass extinction? And most people, when I ask this question, think it's a trick question, and they go, oh, it's probably a nuclear explosion. No, Terry would explode with the energy of a global mass extinction. So the energy equivalent to the city-sized asteroid that slammed into the Earth 66 million years ago and wiped out the dinosaurs. And that gives you some idea of the power of this electrical force. So if you were to unleash it, and we see it unleashed, for instance, in lightning, because we actually see there's a slight charge imbalance. When there's a charge imbalance and this phenomenally powerful force is not neutralized, then we can unleash it. And this is the secret of how electricity can power, you know, all the light bulbs in my house, all the light bulbs in billions of people's houses, their washing machines. This is the secret of how electricity can power the world. We unleash this unbelievably powerful force. And one of the fundamental questions in physics, which we don't know the answer, is how is the electric force? Why is it so much more powerful? Why is it one followed by 40 zeros more powerful, stronger than the gravitational force? We don't know the answer to that.
Hmm. We know it's so strong because of hitting things, don't we? And I always try and visualize when I'm talking to students about, you know, about science, the, you know, the reason we don't put our hand right through the table is not because there's loads of stuff in the way.
Yeah,
there's nothing to do with that, right? If it was just matter, we'd go straight through it. It's the force,
yes,
that is so strong in between these atoms and holding these atoms together that makes the illusion of there being something in the way. But actually, between the electron and the nucleus is just an enormous expanse of space. I always have a big problem with how electrons and nucleus, how they're depicted in books, right? Because am I right in saying that the electron is like miles further out than it looks like in a book?
Yeah, I mean, Tom Stoppard, the British playwright, had this image. He said that if the nucleus in the centre of an atom were like the altar at the centre of St. Paul's Cathedral in London, then an electron would be like a moth in the cathedral, you know, flitting one moment by the dome, the next minute by the altar. But that even that doesn't tell you how empty you are.
Mm.
I can give you as a percent.
Me in particular, Marcus.
You in particular, yeah. As a percentage, or you are 99.999999999999999% empty space. Okay. So this is why, if you could squeeze out all the empty space in all the atoms, in all the 8 billion people on the Earth, the human race would fit in the volume of a sugar cube.
Mad.
Which gives you some idea of how empty it is. So there are objects in space where this has actually happened, where all the empty space has been, you know, driven out. They're called neutron stars. They were discovered by an Irish woman, Jocelyn Bell, in 1967 from Northern Ireland. She discovered pulsars, which are neutron stars. They are basically have the mass of the sun in a volume of the same as, I don't know, Mount Everest. And if you were to go for a neutron star, a sugar cube sized volume would indeed weigh as much as the human race, because, as you pointed out, atoms are mind-bogglingly empty. And it's the electric force, as you say, that stops your hand going through the desk, not the actual solidity of the matter.
I love those little illustrations that you do, and they're all the way through your writing. So if you like just kind of having these ideas and going, oh my God, this is the sort of book for you. Our final one is about global warming. And so what is the one thing that people need to know to understand global warming?
Basically, there are molecules in our atmosphere that absorb the infrared light, which is radiated by the ground. Okay, and this discovery was made by a woman called Eunice Foote, who's been written out of the history of science in 1856. She was an American amateur astronomer, and she did the most incredibly simple experiment that anyone could do at school. You know, she basically put thermometers in glass tubes, sealed them with different gases. So she had one tube with oxygen, one with nitrogen, other one with carbon dioxide, water, water vapor, and she just put them in a greenhouse. And she noticed that the temperature rose dramatically in the tube that contained carbon dioxide and the one that contained water vapor. And this was mind-blowing, because carbon dioxide is only 1/400th of the atmosphere. So this was the first indication that something of pretty much of no consequence, that everyone had thought was no, you know, a minor gas, might have a big effect. And she did speculate that it might be the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere trapping heat that might explain ice ages. And of course, it turns out that water vapor is such a good greenhouse gas that if we didn't actually have it, because we actually really depend on the greenhouse effect, the average temperature of the planet would be minus 18 degrees Celsius. So we all owe our existence here to the greenhouse trapping of heat by water vapor, by water molecules. But, you know, we're worried about this tiny little extra bit, which is unfortunately will actually cause major problems, even though water vapor is the main greenhouse gas.
And so this is actually something that an Irish scientist is very well associated with, right? Tyndall. John Tyndall, famous for his work in the atmosphere. But I hadn't heard of this woman, Eunice Foote.
Eunice Foote, yeah. She was an amateur American astronomer, and it was 3 years before Tyndall. And his work was always, or was independent of hers. And he did a lot more, you know, it was more soundly founded than hers. But she is the person who should be remembered as the person who first recognized the greenhouse effect and that global warming could potentially be a problem.
And so the global warming is sun, energy comes from the sun, it hits objects on the ground, those objects absorb some of that energy and reflect back infrared energy, which then is absorbed and excites the particles, particularly of carbon dioxide. Yeah. But what is it? How are they trapping? What's the trapping bit?
Right. Well, so if you imagine from school, you know, you had these little model, when if you did chemistry, of molecules, you know, with little tiny spheres connected by springs, that obviously they can absorb light when electrons absorb that light, but this isn't what's happening. So imagine that they can oscillate on these little springs. So what the infrared, the light from the sun comes through the atmosphere. The atmosphere is transparent to visible light, so it comes straight through, heats the ground. The ground radiates much lower energy light, which we can't see with the naked eye, but things like pit vipers can actually see infrared. And this is absorbed by molecules in the atmosphere. If you can imagine that they start jiggling a bit faster on their little springs. But an interesting thing is the two molecules that make up most of the atmosphere do not absorb in this way. So molecular oxygen, which is about 20% of the atmosphere, and molecular nitrogen, which is about 70%, but most of the rest.
Yeah.
Fortunately, there's another condition. They have to be connected by these little springs, which they are, but there's a very technical thing. They have to have what's called an electric dipole moment. And these two molecules, because they are symmetric, do not have this. So because if they did, the surface of the atmosphere would be like an oven. But fortunately, the two major gases in the atmosphere do not absorb infrared light, and only this minor one, carbon dioxide.
And that's why we call it a Goldilocks planet, and why we're all alive, I suppose.
A big mystery is why we were warm a long time ago, because the sun is 30% hotter now than it was when the Earth was born.
Is it? 30?
30%, yeah. So basically, this is odd enough. I did a talk in Guildford in south of England last week, and I was taken around by one of the amateur astronomers, and Lewis Carroll lived there. I didn't realise he wrote Alice in Wonderland. And one of the riddles in, I think it's Through the Looking Glass, is what gets hotter as it loses heat? And the answer is the sun or a star. Stars get hotter as they lose heat.
Wow.
So the sun was 30% fainter. So this causes what's called the faint sun paradox. Why was the Earth not frozen solid 4 billion years ago when life started?
Mm.
It clearly wasn't, because we can find evidence in the rocks that there was liquid water. Still a total mystery how it could possibly have been warm, but maybe some kind of greenhouse warming, maybe from molecular hydrogen or something like that, did it. We don't know.
Well, if you like mysteries, you will certainly like this book, because it is all about trying to understand how we might think about things that you find very familiar, you hear about all the time, but actually can sometimes be quite difficult to understand. The author is Marcus Chown, and the book is The One Thing You Need to Know, The Simple Way to Understand the Most Important Ideas in Science. Marcus, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Fall calls for comfort. Mack Weldon's got essentials designed for cool days and timeless style. Their new Ace line combines comfort with sophisticated looks. Go to MackWeldon.com for 20% off your first order of $125 or more with code MACK25.